Welcome to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined alongside my co-host, Jeff, as always. Today, we welcome back film critic and writer Jeff York to talk all things Christmas.
Hello, everybody. This is the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, and Christmas is in the air. So today, we are chatting Christmas movies with our favorite film critic, Mr. Jeff York. So, Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much. Great to be with you guys again.
We were just talking about this before we started recording. You've been flooded with Christmas music and you're in the Christmas spirit and you're ready to talk Christmas movies.
I am. The music starts on the FM Easy Listening Stations November 1 and continues to February 1. So I'm ready for it. I'm hearing it already. And maybe by December 26th, I'll want to hear nothing else but Black Sabbath. But if I want to hear it till February 1, I can.
I've got a question for you. I know we're going to talk about our favorite Christmas movies, maybe weird Christmas movies, movies that, you know, we don't think about as Christmas traditions, but kind of are. So do you have any specific traditions or rituals or movies you queue up every year? What's your Christmas movie tradition?
Well, you know, it's a great question because for years now, there have been a number of the movies that I try to watch each season, like the ones that we'll be talking about tonight that I listed as some of my favorites. I also like to watch all the TV Christmas specials that are kind of in forever rotation, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Charlie Brown Christmas, The Grinch. Some of them haven't aged as well. You know, you watch Rudolph now and it's like, Santa's kind of a scumbag. He really only hires Rudolph because that red nose is going to get him through the storm. I don't know what happens after that. He goes back to being, you know, sort of, you know, the great unwashed or the slave help or something. But it's kind of awful. And he goes, "Oh, Rudolph, will you help us tonight?" And, "Oh, sure, Santa, I'm an indentured servant." And, you know, do you read it now, like different, like suddenly the Island of Misfit Toys is like, and who's the spokesperson there? But Charlie in the Box. And we'll make fun of the Jack in the Box and the guy with the funny nose. And we'll just throw prejudice around like there's no tomorrow. And then, you know, Hermes a little on the off side too, you know, I mean, who knows what we read into that, but it's all about misfits, but then they're kind of only brought into the fold when they can actually do something for them. So it's not exactly the best message for children, but nonetheless, Rankin Bass, I love watching their stop motion photography. It's a lost art in so many respects and it still looks good. And the songs are hummable.
You know, I tell you what, when I was a kid, you know, cause I watched that, you know, religiously as a lot of us did when I was, you know, really little. And that snow monster scared the crap out of me.
Oh yeah. The Bumble. Yeah. And until he's defanged at the end, then suddenly he's like, you know, what kind of medication did Yukon Cornelius put him on? It's like, hey, don't be licking the gold and the silver. Here, have some opiates, you know, but yeah, he was pretty scary. And then, you know, like he's going to eat the Clarice and stuff. And it's like, that isn't something you want to tell children about.
Well, staying on favorite Christmas movies, I want to know, in your guys' opinion, best non-Christmas movie that is a Christmas movie. So, you know, maybe it was released around Christmas, has themes of Christmas, but I'm thinking like Die Hard or Secret Life of Walter Mitty, if we can think of any others as well.
Well, those are definitely two of them for sure. I mean, and there's been that debate for decades now. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Well, of course it is. I mean, it's Christmas from the beginning till end, but, you know, does that mean that Christmas can only be kind of warm and schmaltzy? No, it can be a thriller like that movie is. You know, I like some of the, you know, some of the edgier stuff, I suppose, like Nightmare Before Christmas and some of those that I think are very much embraced as Christmas movies, but they have a little more edge to them. The picks I picked, Andrew, are definitely films that have a little bit of that darkness to it, because I think if you go too saccharine, you can almost get sort of diabetes because it's all so sweet and there's so many things out there. So that's one of the reasons I think The Grinch of all the television Christmas specials has probably stood the best test of time as well, because it was basically saying Christmas shouldn't come from a store. Perhaps, just perhaps, it means a little bit more. But I mean, back in the early 60s, Dr. Seuss was wise enough to look around and go, I think this holiday is, I think Jesus is losing to Santa.
You know, one of my favorite non-Christmas movies, and it's not because it came out at Christmas or anything. It's just, for some reason, I always watch this movie during the Christmas season, is Richard Lester's Three Musketeers from like 1973.
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, it's fantastic. I grew up in the little same town near Andrew. And the theater up in Kankakee, there was a theater. They had a couple of really nice theaters. They had a big Paramount theater, beautiful theater. And one of my friends lived, maybe 10 blocks from the theater. And his neighbor that lived next door to him, they ran the candy store next to the theater. So we walked from his house like 10 blocks up to the Paramount Theater to watch the Three Musketeers, and his neighbor loaded us up on free candy. And so now I watch that movie every Christmas.
That's great. One movie I try to watch at least once a year, not necessarily Christmas, but to answer your question, Andrew, I guess more literally, is I think one of the greatest Christmas movies is maybe one of the darkest, and that is technically Eyes Wide Shut is a Christmas movie.
Oh, wow.
That is going dark.
It is going very dark, but it starts with him attending that Christmas party, and then he meets his old friend Nick Nightingale and gets invited to the special sex party and all that kind of stuff. So it's in some respects, it's kind of like even the darker side of Love Actually. I think one of the reasons that Love Actually has sort of endured as this sort of modern classic is that Richard Curtis had the audacity to release an R-rated Christmas movie that is as sort of, you know, sweet and treacly as anything that you might find on the Hallmark Channel. And yet on the other side of it, you've got Martin Freeman and, you know, portraying an actor who's a stand-in for a porn movie. And that's one of the love stories in Love Actually. Explain that one to the children. I don't think that makes the cut on TBS. But when it came out, I remember thinking, wow, this is a fairly dirty Christmas movie. But then there's been a few of them. I mean, Bad Santa and Eyes Wide Shut. Certainly there's been a number of horror movies, even Gremlins back in the day when I was in college. Gremlins came out and a lot of people thought that was blasphemous, making all this fun of, you know, doing a monster movie with the backdrop of Christmas. But I think it's a fun counter. And I think that, you know, if you're a clever filmmaker, there shouldn't be any real sort of sacred cows.
Well, I'm curious, you know, one of my favorite Christmas films is It's a Wonderful Life, and yep, been around forever. Yep. How do you think modern Christmas movies compare to some of the old classics in terms of themes and storytelling?
Well, it's funny. I think that's one of the ones that has stood the test of time again, because it's not only very well done. I mean, Capra knew what he was doing, and Jimmy Stewart's one of the best leading actors of all time, but it's also dark. I mean, this is about a man who's thinking about ending his life and at the end of his rope, and he's battling depression, and it's really dark. And even, you know, the banks taking away people's money and all that kind of stuff. I think it sort of plays to something primal that we can respond to, particularly I think because Christmas is a stressful holiday. It's not all, you know, the perfect, you know, Toyota, you know, savings, big new car in the driveway with a bow on it, kinds of fantasy worlds. It's, you know, families getting together, sometimes fighting, you're sort of pressured into doing things or feeling you have to get it all in a couple of days. And it's kind of manic. And I think there's a stress to it that maybe comes out through some of these darker films, or films that certainly either make fun of it or go, you know, in a different direction than sort of the goo.
As a film critic, I'm curious, do you think the holiday season influences the storytelling and maybe even the cinematography in movies, or certain elements of a movie that make you realize you're watching a Christmas movie, even if you don't see, you know, a Christmas tree or presents, you just turn one on, you just know right away it is one?
Yeah, that's a great question, Andrew. And I think it does, because there are so many tropes and sort of, if you will, touch point cliches that everybody recognizes Christmas. As soon as you have any kind of bells going, you're in the Christmas season. And that can just be in the background of soundtrack, because it is kind of throughout Die Hard. It's used as a punctuation point for a couple of sort of funny scenes for the laughs in it, when Bruce Willis says something smart or snarky, or Willie Matheny, I think, gets punched at the end by Bonnie Bedelia. It plays a little, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem, I think, with doing a really good Christmas movie, is you're sort of stuck with the tree and the lights and all the suburban homes put together. So I think, you know, people like John Hughes and Richard Curtis and all those guys, when they tend to do them, there's a sweetness to them, but there's also a real need to sort of make fun of that stuff and sort of slice and dice it, because it is so, you have to do this and it has to be this and this is the cliche. And, you know, so when John Hughes did Christmas Vacation, he wrote a script that was pretty nasty about trying to just get the family together. And there's been a whole bunch of those kind of things since then. I mean, in some respects, that's almost become the theme now of most Christmas movies, if they come out with them, because I think nobody would dare do one that's just sort of straight down the middle, aiming for the heart and calling it a day. Even the stuff, the love stories on Hallmark, it's gotten edgier with, you know, gay love stories or mixed race love stories or Susan Lucia's Scrooge. You know, they always find ways to do the story with a little bit of acid and a little bit of difference to get away from those cliches.
What about weird Christmas movies? I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I for the life of me, cannot remember what it was called. I think it might have been a foreign film because the, you know, it was out of sync, the voices didn't match, and it was like Santa and I don't know if it was Martians or aliens. It was just weird. And
well, there's one with Pia Zadora from it. I think it was Santa Claus versus the Martians or something like that. some of those sneak through and you wonder, what in the hell were they thinking with some of those? But somebody thought, oh, this will be funny. I'm going to
and they're strange. They're so strange.
Yes. Yeah, it's really true. There's a bunch of those other. There was one when I was a kid that was in theaters and it was a foreign film and it was called The Christmas That Almost Wasn't.
Do you remember that one? I think so. Tell me. Keep going.
Well, there was this businessman. I forget. I think his name was Crude or Cruel or something like that, who didn't like Christmas because he was, you know, a forgotten child at the orphanage or something. So he was going to use all of his money to basically somehow, I don't know, buy out Santa Claus or whatever he was doing to make sure Christmas didn't come around. Again, probably somebody said, you know, that Grinch book sold millions. Let's do our version of it. But it was a musical. And the big theme was there once was a Christmas that almost wasn't, almost wasn't, almost wasn't. And, you know, then they get some local dad, I think, to help save it. And, you know, we've seen that theme now with Tim Allen and Will Ferrell and everybody else under the sun. But yeah, some of those really, you know, movies that combined, I mean, how about Black Christmas? They've remade that a couple of times and it's just, that's so sad. But I mean, you know, they gave Grumpy Cat his own TV special where, you know, Grumpy Cat's Grumpy Christmas or whatever. So yeah, there's some people have been really probably on some heavy duty drugs when they came up with the ideas for those.
Wasn't there some weird Star Wars Christmas special that was on TV?
Oh, yeah.
TV
in
that
fact, everybody tries to live it down and not talk about it. But whenever they want to sort of slam George Lucas, they bring up the fact that he made all the actors in that do a Christmas special.
I think I saw some clips of that not too long ago. And yeah, it's weird. It's very weird.
I don't know if you remember this, just to get off topic for a second, but E.T. was so popular in its day in 1982 that they did a special on E.T. with the cast of that doing things like just talking about E.T. or singing songs about E.T. And then, of course,
I don't remember that. That's
it was strange. It was so weird. It was like, you know, sometimes they would do that just to capitalize on something that was popular. I mean, they gave the Starland Vocal Band their own summer replacement series back in the 70s and they had one hit song and it was about having sex in the afternoon delight. And they sang it every one of the six shows they did for that summer season. And I'm sitting there watching that as a kid, I think it was like in fifth grade, knowing this is a song about doing it, isn't it? What the heck?
And but, it's got bad grammar.
There
that song
you go.
Drives me crazy because it's just, it's like, come on.
But yeah, there's a lot of weirdness that sort of occurs around the holiday season. And like you said, some of those movies, by the way, it was Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. I just looked it up on IMDb.
Wow.
Yeah. Because that's what Santa Claus had to do. He wasn't busy enough just making toys and doing that crazy run on Christmas night. No, he has to keep us from the invading Martians.
Well, he's a busy guy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, growing up in the early 2000s, I may have a little bit of a different answer to the weird Christmas movie, but it's,
you youngin.
This is a movie that, like, I didn't think was weird at a time. I'd watch it all the time, even outside of Christmas, but I've rewatched it recently, and that's Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sinbad. But yes, that's just one of those, again, like, you don't see like a Christmas movie like that being made anymore either.
No, in fact, you wouldn't find many really big stars as he was at the time doing something like that to try to appeal to even a bigger audience that he was getting with most of his blockbusters. By the way, here's a little trivia for you. What famous actor who starred in a number of television series in the 60s and 70s played the misbegotten policeman who is sort of always falling down or getting sort of slammed by Arnold and Sinbad during their shenanigans in that movie.
I have no idea.
I have no idea.
Robert
either, but...
Conrad, the man who played in the Wild Wild West. Yep. Wow. Robert Conrad was one of Robert Conrad's last sort of, if you will, I guess, tentpole or big movies that he made, even though it was a supporting role. But he was the tough cop who was always being thwarted by those two crazy out of control dads looking for that toy.
Well, staying on the topic of like Christmas movies, and we've talked about ones from years ago and even recent ones. I'm curious what you think makes a Christmas movie timeless to a certain degree.
Well, that's a great question too. You guys have such good questions. I love you guys. I think it has to be not too of the moment, because I think if it seems a little too trendy, I think it then just is aged out in a couple of years. I mean, you watch Seinfeld today and you are shocked that it's 30 years old. It doesn't look that old. Now, sure, there's a couple times when you say, oh, Jerry's got a mullet, or I'm not sure anybody would wear that sweater today, but it looks, you know, pretty modern or at least timeless compared to something like Saved by the Bell, which I think by the time they edited and put that on the air Saturday mornings, it was already out of date with the need to constantly be on trend with those terrible 80s fashions. But I think that there has to be a kind of timelessness to the storytelling without being too trendy, and also something that I think even if it's a Christmas movie, it has to do things that arguably zig when others would zag. I'll give you
an
example.
What do you mean? Oh,
well, I'll tell you one that I think is, this is always a big discussion for me with people about the very, very many versions of the Tale of Scrooge that have been out there. And there's everything from, you know, Reginald Owen's version in 36 to Bill Murray's version around in the mid-1990s in Scrooged. But I think the best one that's ever been done, and there's been many good ones. I like George C. Scott's version and Patrick Stewart's and some others. I even kind of have a soft spot for Albert Finney in the musical Scrooged, which doesn't have many great songs in it, but it wasn't a bad film. It was maybe just an okay film or an okay musical. But my favorite Christmas movie of all time is A Christmas Carol from 1951 with Alastair Sim.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
And it's great for two big, humongous reasons that I don't know if any other Christmas Carol has done as well. And the first is between, you know, the producer who was... The two producers, I think it was Brian Desmond Hurst and Stanley Haynes, they hired Brian Desmond Hurst, who had done a lot of noir and scary films. He had done a version of The Telltale Heart, and he had done some detective noir features. And they correctly noted that A Christmas Carol is a ghost story.
Yeah.
It's a scary story. And it's about a person who's supposed to sort of make people shake with dread and not, you know, like Shamor Cadger shaking his bony finger. Are there no workhouses? Are there no orphanage? It's not Dana Carvey. It's the kind of most intimidating man in the town of London.
Right.
And Alastair Sim, who was mostly a comedic actor, but this is one of the great things about casting in films. A lot of times you cast these comedic actors in these roles where they have to go dark, and it works out fantastically well. And Alastair Sim with those heavy lids and his sort of, you know, rack of teeth that could almost look like shark's teeth, sort of big ass teeth staring at you. He was intimidating, and he played it mean as hell from the get-go until he has the conversion. And then, of course, because he's a great comedic actor, he makes the conversion not only joyful, but hilarious. He's right. Really funny. And you buy it because that man can do that stuff. You know, when George, these guys going like, hey, it's Christmas, I haven't missed it. You know, I still can't get the shots of him saying, get that off the screen, that's my daughter, and hardcore. But Alastair Sim was by nature a comedic actor and really able to make that transition. But he knew his resting bitch face was just that. He looked intimidating. And against this noir setting, which we were going for, it really worked well. And I'll tell you one other thing I'll just say that added to it. And like everybody across the board really got it in this film, but the music was done by a British composer named Richard Adinsell. And you can find his work, including a suite from A Christmas Carol, on Spotify and in some CD stores. But it was a straight up horror score. I mean, it could have easily been scored for Frankenstein or The Mummy or something like that. I mean, I don't know if you remember how it opens, but it shows the book opening and then it says, you know, Scrooge by Charles Dickens, and the music comes in. It goes bum 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 bum. It's just holy crap! How many sharps and flats are in that series of notes? I mean, it's really dark. It's really intimidating sounding. And you know, if you're a kid, you'll watch it because you want to be scared, and that's an appeal to it. But it was definitely adult story, a film like a noir or horror story noir. And recognizing the full extent of the nastiness of what Dickens wrote and the ghost story, and only sort of the twist in the last act where suddenly it turns into more bright and cheery Christmas.
Yeah, that movie scared the crap out of me when I watched as a kid. It kind of reminds me of, I don't know, I guess because it was so scary, but you know, watching The Wizard of Oz as a little kid is terrifying.
That's a great comparison. Kids have always liked to be scared. I mean, they love Snow White, and that witch was horrifying. You know, they had to reupholster the Radio City Music Hall seats after the premiere showing because all the kids wet the seats. They were terrified. But kids like to be scared. They always have. Ghost stories and scary stories always appeal to kids. I loved Edgar Allan Poe as a child. And Alistair Sim plays it scary, and the whole movie plays really as a horror film. And, you know, as soon as you see Marley's ghost and he comes clanking in with all those lock boxes and chains, it's terrifying. And Scrooge is terrified. We're terrified in the audience. And then, you know, when Scrooge is like, he might just be an undigested bit of beef, a leftover potato. And then Marley stands up and shrieks, "Oh, you believe in me." And it's like, oh my God, we're all cowering.
Yeah. I mean, transitioning from scary Christmas movies to more non-scary ones, one of my favorite ones that I can't believe is turning 20 years old this year, and one that I think feels modern but timeless at the same time, and wondering to get your thoughts on how maybe they achieved this, is Elf.
Oh yeah, that's a great one. In fact, I think other than Love Actually, that's the only really sort of, for lack of a better term, beloved classic in the last 20 years, and maybe even eclipsing Love Actually, because a lot of kids can watch Love Actually, or they couldn't when it came out because it was rated R. And Elf has been turned into a Broadway musical, and it's, you know, it's a quotable movie. It's really funny, and it's Will Ferrell, you know, at the kind of height of his powers. But I think it stood up very well. And I think the funny thing about that is it's I guess maybe sort of what the topic is here. It's both sort of, you know, the sort of comedy and tragedy masks together. It's funny because it's Will Ferrell and he's this humongous elf. And, you know, there's all these scenes where he's up in the North Pole and they shoot it with the perspective where he's humongous compared to all these little people. Bob Newhart, you know.
Bob Newhart.
It's very, very, very funny, very satirical. They're making fun of it. You know, even paying a little homage to Hermie the Elf, I think, with the Misfit Elf. And then when he gets to, you know, Manhattan, and he's, of course, a complete fish out of water and, you know, is naive to the point of abstraction. And, you know, you have James Caan of all people playing kind of the comedic foil, and he's very funny. But it doesn't forget to also touch your heart in it. And it is about a family reunion. And, you know, if you look at it, really the conversion in there is kind of James Caan. He's got more of the arc. So I think that to your great credit, Andrew, it is a classic film. And I think it works because it both makes fun of Christmas, but still finds its heart when it has to. And like most of the better Christmas movies, I think saves the sweetness and the goo for really the last 15 minutes. And up until then, it's more outrageous or raucous or dirty or scary. I think those are the ones that tend to be a little bit better. I mean, you think about even The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. 80% of that easily is negative as hell. You know, he's stealing everything and not even leaving the crumb for the rat, and, you know, lying to Cindy Lou through his teeth, and, you know, leaving the Who's with nothing. And, you know, even, and he's abusing Max the dog, but we watch that because it's like, oh my God, after, you know, laughing through, you know, Christmas carols and grandma's, you know, bad presents and more socks for mom because she doesn't want to buy us. It's fun to watch a movie that kind of is a little nasty, and even a half hour special like that has enough sense to be kind of have the cold, icy heart until it grows three times its size that day in the last 10 minutes.
Well, you know, it's funny. You talk about films that are kind of oh gosh, what's the word I'm saying? You know, they're not sticky sweet from the beginning.
Right.
And this is a phrase or a word Andrew uses all the time when we're working on screenplays. You know, it's got to be earned. It's yes. got to be earned. And if nice. You save that emotional turn for the very, you know, till you absolutely have to have it, it just makes for a better story.
It does. And I think that's where the tension and drama in any story comes from. And I think most of the better movies, even if they're laugh out loud comedies, there has to be stakes that matter. And,
right.
you know, you could argue that, for example, in August Wilson's play, The Piano Teacher, they're arguing over the heirloom piano that their mother left them. And the son, who's the lead character, wants to sell it because he needs money. He's got debts and he knows that this is an antique and they can make some money, which in the time period in the South for the African-American family that they're portraying here was more money than they would normally get from, you know, a month's wages or whatever, because of this great thing that they happen to have. Those are his stakes. Now, nobody's going to die. Nobody's going to get beat up over it. It's really a conflict between the brother and his sister about who's going to get control over the family, i.e. fortune, in this piano. But those are big stakes. And for him, that is, in a version, life and death. And whether it's a goofy Christmas movie or, you know, Scrooge fearing that he's going to go to hell or walk the earth as a, you know, ghost who's carrying around chains, those are the stakes as he realizes, as he's shown more of his past, what a shit he was, and he needs to straighten up and fly right ASAP, otherwise he's doomed. So, yeah, and then you have to go through some sort of journey to earn that, as you said, Andrew. Otherwise, it's like, oh, I just needed to see the carolers out on the front of the house singing, and now I'm in the mood. That's not enough. It's got to be more dramatic.
Well, let's shift over to best Christmas movie soundtracks. Anything stand out?
Well, I tell you, for me, the probably greatest Christmas music soundtrack that I can't believe everybody listens to, it's still in number 10, top 10 bestseller every Christmas, is actually a TV special, and that's A Charlie Brown Christmas, the Vince Guaraldi Trio.
That's a good one.
Jazzy yeah. music. Who would have thought, you know, I mean, it was very 60s, very Brubeck-esque in its way, and yet it's got a Christmassy kind of essence and heart to it, but it's so jazzy. I mean, even when they do the little drummer boy with the kids choir and they're singing a little bit flat, and it's, you know, not quite the traditional Vienna schoolboys choir version of it, but it's more
but
of
it's
a,
awesome though. It's a so jazz. Good.
It is. And it's just, and it's so distinct. As soon as you hear Christmas Time Is Here with those piano chords, just playing it, and the snare drum with the brushes on it, it's, you're just transported. And, you know, it helps that I think that's a great special anyhow. And it tells what the real meaning of Christmas is. It's not a Christmas tree. Or a pageant. It's actually this very humble, sad story about this, you know, sort of almost non-birth of, because he was stuck out in the cold, story. But that, to me, right off the top of my bat, right off the top of my head, hits me as like a home run out of the park, because it's such a great, unique soundtrack. And, you know, it was all original. I mean, they weren't sampling the greatest Christmas songs or tunes of all time, like, you know, they did in Love Actually. It's a great soundtrack and there's some very good stuff in it, but most of those are songs that were 5, 10, 20, 30 years old. What do you guys think? I mean, what do you like as far as what music scores from Christmas movies appeal to you or you stick with you?
Oh, I don't know. That's kind of hard to top that. That was a good answer. I didn't
see
that
you.
One coming. I should have known that one, because I listened to that one. That's in my rotation. But
I'll take Christmas songs for 1,000, Alex.
Yeah, that was a good answer.
I just made the run of the board. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So, like, if people haven't heard from your previous episode, you told an amazing Steven Spielberg story, which is about your writing journey a little bit. And as a writer, I'm curious if you were hired or wanted to write a Christmas or holiday season script, would your writing change at all? How would that influence how you would tackle a story, if it would change it at all?
Fascinating question. I haven't ever really thought about it. Some people have told me, in fact, I know some people who've written some very good Christmas movies and, you know, done them consistently. And oftentimes they'll say, you know, this is a great end because you know, various cable channels are looking for those each year. And if you could even do one that a movie studio would be willing to invest in, because, you know, right now, most often or not, it seems there's Christmassy kinds of animated films and those get very pricey, but, you know, there's not a lot of romantic comedies being done anymore, but they might be done if they were Christmas themed, because that supposedly appeals to a four quadrant audience. But I would have to find a very different take on it. I'll tell you one that I will share with you, and hopefully somebody doesn't steal this out there. But I think there might be an opportunity to really go a little crazier and a little darker in more realistic ways that are still a little bit out there. Versions of family get-togethers, because the more I talk to people and hear about what their Christmas traditions are like or their get-togethers, everybody's got one of those weird stories. And they've done some of that. Like, there was that Thanksgiving movie that Jodie Foster directed, and The Family Stone with Rachel McAdams and Sarah Jessica Parker. And, you know, a couple of those things that are a little dark, like Four Christmases with Vince Vaughn and Reese Witherspoon. They're not bad. But I think sometimes just the weird dynamics, like if I was going to do a Christmas movie script, I think I would call it 5 days in hell. And you think, well, what is that about? Well, it's 5 days with your family at home for the holidays. And you're stuck there for the 5 days because you can't get on the plane until January 2nd or whatever it is. So you're stuck there that whole week. Because I think without being, you know, the incestual family members that were in The Christmas Vacation and some of those kind of things, there's just plenty of weirdness, like just the sleeping assignments in the house when the relatives are coming over, and who gets stuck on a cot or who's on the floor, or, you know, who's having to share a bed because there aren't enough bedrooms to go around. That stuff can be crazy. And I'll just give you one quick example of it. One Christmas, we had our family over. My mom's side of her family were mostly older people in their 70s and 80s. She was an only child, and all of her family were aunts and uncles from who were now aging. And when my brother and I were in college, somehow my uncle Merlin and his wife ended up in one bedroom, and my brother ended up having to sleep with my mom in the bigger bed because I was in the smaller bed in this other room that was just like a twin size bed or whatever. And my brother comes in the middle of the night and says, "Move over. I'm sleeping with you." And I go, it's a small bed. It's in the middle of the night. He says, "Move over. I'll tell you what happened in the morning." So he tells me what happened in the morning. Uncle Merlin, who was kind of, you know, dealing with Alzheimer's a little bit then and, you know, not knowing where he was, he went into my mom's bedroom thinking it was the bathroom, and he started to pee on the bed.
Oh, wow.
And wow. So that's, you know, that kind of stuff happens in with families and weird assignments to who's in what bed and stuff. So my mother got him out, stopped him before he made too much of a damage. Thank God he was only going number one, but she ushered him out and quickly said to Greg, "You might want to go sleep with your brother, because I don't think I'm going to sleep in this room anymore." And she's, you know, doing laundry in the middle of the night. And that was one of those weird stories. But, you know, there's lots of those kind of things that are just, you know, like the pebble in your shoe enough to make it irritating without having to have people falling off of the roofs and taking down the Christmas tree lights with them and all that stuff. But I think those kind of things everybody can relate to, because family tensions, and then when you're stuck together for those amount of days and you really don't have much in common anymore, it can get a little bit irritating. And I think just this sort of sly comedy of manners, almost like if you would hand it to Alexander Payne. Like, did you see, I thought The Holdovers, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, is an excellent Christmas movie. I hope that's finding an audience. And I think that might develop as a kind of cult Christmas movie, because it's about three people who are at a high school who end up having to hold over there during the Christmas holidays. Everybody else goes away for break. And they're kind of three misfits, one teacher, one cook, and then one student who can't go home. And they, you know, do a little of a road trip, but mostly it's just very easygoing, calm things that happen. But still, they get on each other's nerves because people get on each other's nerves. And, you know, when you're in a contained space like that and you don't have many options, that's where a lot of times real comedy comes from without having to go too crazy.
Well, I'd love to see your script that you were talking about with the family staying together. It sounds like a modern day James Thurber kind of story. I think that could be fun.
Thank you. I think it could be. I mean, people have told me, literally, you guys are you know, that's encouraging because I've told people that story before and people go, you're kidding. It's like, no, that actually happened. And there's some other stories kind of in that realm. And, you know, some of it is maybe, unfortunately, maybe seen as making fun of old people today. So maybe there's ageism in that. But I mean, I think you have to make fun of all kinds of people when you're doing a comedy. And that's just one of the ones you take a shot at. But there's a lot of stories like that out there. And I know I've got dozens of them. So someday with your inspiration, guys, I may give it a shot. Maybe I'll start over Christmas. You
know, that's what makes a, that's what makes a Christmas story so great. I mean, families are complicated and funny and weird and conflicted. And there's a lot of stuff to mine there, especially for a good Christmas movie.
And I think that's one of those Christmas classics too. I think it started out as a cult classic and now it's become really one of the top probably three or four staples for people. I mean, you know, I think you'd say they watch the TV specials, but then after that, a movie that people probably all watch is either that one or Elf. I would say those are probably the two biggest ones that people return to again and again and have great feelings for. And you're right. That was late 40s version of sort of dysfunctional family. I mean, my God, Carl Kolchak played the dad, Darren McGavin. Oh, nobody's idea of a warm dad.
Such a great actor.
And he was so funny in it too. But yeah, that one I think succeeded for all the reasons we've talked about.
Well, Jeff, this has been fun. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And enjoy the Christmas music, the Christmas movies, and let's circle back in the new year and chat again.
I'd love that. You guys are terrific and love your show and everybody should listen.
All right. Take care, buddy.
Okay, my friend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, a podcast created and hosted by filmmakers Jeff Stolen and Andrew Lamping and produced by Melody Lopez.
Our theme music was created by a man who is wishing all of you a very Merry Christmas, Stephen D. Bennett.
Make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on and stay tuned for future episodes.